From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, over the last several years, the science of brain health and the study of epigenetics, which is the way our behavior affects the expression of our genes, have converged around a basic hopeful message. And that is, the lifestyle choices you make today can significantly improve the trajectory of your future brain health, regardless of your genetics. Joining us is Dr. Michelle Braun, a Harvard and Yale-trained neuropsychologist who has written a book on the science of Alzheimer's disease. It's called High Octane Brain, 5 Science-Based Steps to Sharpen Your Memory and Reduce Your Risk of Alzheimer's. I spoke with Dr. Braun last week. This is a taped interview. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Dr. Braun, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as you say, and we all know it's true, anyone over 40 fears dementia or Alzheimer's disease more than just about anything else, including cancer. I think it's because we know that we have no control over it, or we think we don't. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're here today to sort of help us sift through and figure out what we can do to stave off effects from dementia or Alzheimer's.
Exactly. And it is really empowering to know that there is so much we can do to alter our brain health trajectory, not only in the future for minimizing the risk of Alzheimer's, but also so that we can benefit in current day. So that's kind of what I love about these techniques, is they have an immediate payoff and a long-term payoff.
One of the things that I think we all accept and sometimes we brush off as being distracted in this modern age of technology, when we're listening to someone and texting someone else at the same time and, you know, all of the myriad other things that we do, we pass it off as sort of a brain blip. But really, to what degree is our lack of attention playing into all of this? And how much do we really need to practice focus as a means to sort of combat this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because focus is really the recipe, the antidote to a lot of the brain blips we all experience. And so by brain blips, we could think of when we walk into a room and we're not sure what we wanted to do in the room or what we wanted to get. Or for example, if we misplace a commonly used object like keys or a wallet, there, as you mentioned, are times when we are maybe not focusing as much on what we're doing. I often think of it like we're going into autopilot mode. Our brain is so good at knowing what we repeat frequently and not necessarily being fully present for those things, because it focuses instead on novelty. It focuses instead on things that are different. And so what we can do is take the reins back from our brain that's going on autopilot and force it to focus by doing something called a pause point, which is basically a 5-second pause that we take before we go into a room or as we are putting an object down, where we make our brain disconnect from that autopilot and focus. And that can be very powerful in giving us a sense of control over our memory.
Okay, so tell me how this pause goes. I've pulled into the garage in my car. I'm thinking about the next thing I'm going to do as soon as I'm going to go into the kitchen and start making dinner, whatever it is. In that time, I do something with my keys. I'm not sure what, because I haven't paused to actually make note of exactly what I want to do with my keys. So how does a scenario like that get a redo?
That's a great question. So with physical objects like keys, purses, glasses, etc., we want to rely on something called a home space, which is a dedicated place that the object goes. And you can then use the autopilot of your brain to your advantage, because you can train yourself to put the object in that home space repeatedly without having to think too much about it. Where we get into trouble is when we're putting an object in an unfamiliar place or a place outside of our home space. And in that case, what I would recommend you try to do is become present of what you're holding in your hands. I know that might sound odd, but most of the time, if we can make ourselves just kind of force ourselves to look at what we have, that in and of itself is a pause point. And that awareness comes from realizing from a tactile standpoint that we're holding something. So you're going in to make dinner, you realize you're holding something, you look down at what it is, you see it's your keys, you put it into the home space. If you walk past the home space, you still feel them in your hands and you look down and you say, okay, I'm putting them on the counter, and you're looking at those on the counter in the context of the other things on the counter. And so then you have that sense of recall as opposed to thinking, I have no idea where I put them.
Is that playing to several senses at the same time? Or is there something very strong about the tactile sense, a sense of touch? I think when I would look down at my hand, if I forced myself to do that and saw the whatever in my hand, it's a visual memory that I can come back to. But can you talk a little bit about that? Which of the senses do we need to, you know, bring this into focus?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you asked that, because multi-sensory memory is the strongest, because we want to lay information down across multiple senses if we can. So for example, by looking at it, by feeling it, and then by thinking about it, we have created multiple highways, so to speak, that we've laid the information down in our brain. And the odds are, if one of those falters, one of those recall threads, the other two remain. And so as much as possible, we want to use multiple senses to encode information, to learn it.
The book is High Octane Brain, 5 Science-Based Steps to Sharpen Your Memory and Reduce Your Risk of Alzheimer's. My guest is Dr. Michelle Braun. She's a Harvard and Yale-trained neuropsychologist. And Michelle, you give us some insights, some inspiring insights, you say, from 9 high-octane brain role models. They start at age 44, which I think is, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, about the time when lots of people start thinking, wow, I just can't remember people's names anymore. And I used to be able to do that all the time. Does that happen right around 40?
Yeah, I think that's when we start to become gradually more aware of it. But what's interesting is before we have our conscious awareness of those changes, starting even in our mid-20s is when we start to see changes in our ability to process information. And we start seeing memory changes even in our early 30s. Again, those are only if you're examining those functions in a really precise way with tests, and we're not as aware of those changes. But that's another reason that I really wanted this information out there, is because brain aging starts a lot earlier than most of us think. And by using these techniques proactively, so thinking about bringing them on board and making them just a part of our daily lives, we are combating the rate of age-related decline. So what that means is when we, over time, use these techniques, our brain is younger at a tissue level than our chronological age is.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, you know, you have some people who have joined you in your high octane brain work. Start with a 44-year-old, and then you work with people up to 103 years old. Boy, you'd think by 103, you would have really mastered this.
Yeah. And so each of the role models is really highlighted in the book because I wanted to share how they achieved a high octane brain in the context of a lot of the life stresses we all experience. In other words, this is not just for a select few people. This is not for people who have stressless lives. This is for all of us in the midst of the daily travails that we have. And I'm happy to tell you that the 103-year-old turned 105 today on the day of the book release, Edna. And so she's been an inspiration to me and to so many others. And I really wanted to highlight those stories so that we can imagine ourselves as those older adults, maybe in our hundreds as well, having high octane brains.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about what those people are doing. What are the main tips? And maybe it starts off with sort of determining if you have an issue and how to go through with yourself, just, you know, the old attention and memory evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of the folks that are profiled have done a really good job at integrating some sort of physical activity into their lives on a consistent basis. And what I wanted to show is that that's a really personal decision, how people engage and move with joy. So there is no specific type of exercise that all of them were doing. They were all doing different things that they really felt engaged them and allowed them to pass the time and they loved. So I also wanted to highlight that's a big part of the book itself, is that these five steps really need to be personalized in order to stick. Because we've all heard and maybe internally just thought, oh, I don't want to have to do X, Y, or Z when it's really specifically prescribed to us. But when we know we have latitude, when we know that we can be like the role models and pick and choose what works best for us, that is empowering. So all of them had the physical exercise in common. They were all having some healthy foods, brain healthy foods, and some of them liked others more than specific types of foods more than others. And so that was personalized as well. And all of them also exhibited resilience under stress. And so they all had trials and tribulations, which I highlighted in many cases, but they were very hardy and they had a lot of grit. They had a lot of ability to pursue their goals in the midst of challenge. And I think that that's a lesson for all of us. And I think as we are in the challenging times we are right now, in the midst of COVID-19 and all of the changes with that, it does all of us well to reflect our own resilience, how we have been able to make it through challenging times in the past, because that's where we are right now in many ways as well.
Absolutely. So we've heard this a lot about fitness and exercise, of course, brain healthy foods, and then as you say, resilience, developing grit. But let's start with that, the one about exercise. What actually is happening to our brains? Obviously we're oxygenating things more, but what physiologically is happening there?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because so many times when I talk about exercise, people say, well, I already knew that. But the point of this book is to show the specific types, the duration, and like you're asking, how does that impact the brain? Because when people know that, they become kind of hooked on making these changes happen. So what I want you to do is just imagine if you curled your thumb in front of yourself, like held up your hand and curled your thumb. That same type of size and shape structure is about an inch and a half in under each ear. It's called the hippocampus, and it is the memory processing center of our brain. It's where all of the information comes in, and it's almost acting like a switchboard. It's taking information in, packaging it up, sending it off for storage. And in a fascinating way, that is where cardiovascular exercise does its work, is on the hippocampus. It targets that organ so that people, for example, who are exercising frequently have more density in that tissue. That tissue grows. There is something called BDNF. It's a growth factor that actually gets planted. It's sort of like the seedlings of new neurons are planted in the hippocampus with exercise. And so if we had a drug that did that, that actually preferentially grew our memory center, I think everybody would be taking it. But it's as easy as exercise.
Absolutely. BDNF. Okay. And so any particular intensity or duration of exercise?
Yeah. So what we know is that any kind of movement is better than none. So I really want to empower people to know that this is not, you do not have to be running marathons and have strenuous activity happening, especially if you have any issues with movement or pain. Working in concert with your healthcare provider is really the best strategy. But if you don't have any limitations physically and you've been given the thumbs up from a medical perspective, then moderate intensity cardiovascular exercise of at least 22 minutes a day, which sounds like a funny amount, but it's basically 150 minutes a week, is very therapeutic for the brain. And so by moderate intensity, we can measure that with something we call the TOC test. And that means that you're breathing and huffing and puffing to a degree where you can't sing, but you can still talk. Mm-hmm. You could take it up to the next level of vigorous intensity if you wanted to, and there you can't talk either. You're huffing and puffing to the degree that you can't speak a full sentence. But that's really the level, that moderate intensity level that we're after, at least 22 minutes a day. And you can go up to 45 minutes a day and still see good therapeutic benefit from that.
Well, excellent. Okay, let's talk about the two power foods. You talk about food, but specifically these two power foods that have shown unique ability to sharpen memory and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. What are they?
Okay, one is dark green leafy vegetables.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
We've heard a lot about the therapeutic effects of those, and in the brain, they're very, very helpful from an antioxidant perspective. So this is kale, this is spinach, this is greens, and having just one serving a day has been shown to decrease the rate of brain aging by over 10 years. If people had one of those servings every day for 10 years, their rate of brain aging is slowed by 7.5 years, which is just amazing. Again, if we had a medication or drug that did that, I cannot imagine someone who would not take it. But it's there in the food. The second is berries. So whereas other diets like the Mediterranean diet, DASH diet, they don't specify a specific fruit type, the MIND diet, which is profiled MIND, is a diet that advocates berries in particular. And so people who were having 2 to 3 servings of berries actually a week were again showing significant slowing of their cognitive aging. So I just like to say, you know, of all of the really brain healthy foods that are out there, if you can target those two, those are the highest foods that give you the greatest benefit over time.
And I just want to mention, because I've gotten very into massaging my kale recently, that, you know, kale's one of these great things, but it's, you know, most people, they'll buy it and then they'll say, oh, what do I do with this? It's rough. And so a little salt, a little olive oil, and massage it with your hands. It kind of breaks it down and makes it easy to eat.
I do that too. Yes. And you can have it in smoothies. You know, there are so many ways that you can, take the food and make it your own again in ways that are tasty to you. And that's what I recommend with everything we're talking about, is you take the recommendation and personalize it to your life. And it takes a little bit of trial and error to do that, but then you're getting the best of all worlds. You're getting the science and you're making it your own.
Absolutely. And when you talk about berries, we know blueberries are great, but blueberries, raspberries, all the way to what, goji berries, it's all good.
Yeah, so the MIND diet does not specify berry type, but there are other research studies suggesting that blueberries in particular seem to have a little bit more of an edge in some ways with antioxidants.
Oh, very interesting. Okay, so most of us wonder if our inability to remember people's names when we used to be able to do so, or whatever it is it just we're oversaturated with information, or when do we know when it's a true warning sign of a memory problem?
That's a great question. It's an important one because so many people are concerned about memory and they want to know what is that dividing line. And I think that if you can remember 3 things that tell you that the warning signs are there, the first is forgetfulness for well-known information that may even be personal, like where you went to high school or what year you might have started your first job. And some of us never paid attention to the year we started our first job in the first place. So it should be forgetfulness for information you personally knew well in the past about yourself. Secondly, that those memory challenges have increased over time. In other words, they didn't just happen because you didn't sleep well the night before or that you're stressed. It's a pattern where you and loved ones often notice it before the person themselves, if there's a pattern. So that's the second. And the third is that there is no reason that anyone is able to point to why those changes are occurring. So again, having memory problems can happen for a variety of reasons that are not concerning, like maybe there's a vitamin deficiency, maybe there is stress or a sleep disorder. And so that's where the medical workup becomes really important, to talk to your healthcare provider and have them help you dice out what exactly the cause could be.
Oh, that's great. And included in the book, I'm sure, are ways to find those kind of cognitive tests that are effective and are the ones that we really should be taking if we have, you know, some pretty significant concern.
Right. And that's where the neuropsychological assessment comes in. And so that is my focus, is as a neuropsychologist. Many of my referrals are coming from neurologists or primary care providers who are saying, okay, my patient is reporting some memory challenges. On an in-office screener, you know, which is a very quick screener that's not diagnostic, they're having some challenges. Can you help get us a sense from a detailed perspective of what's happening in all of the different brain regions? And that's where those really detailed tests come in. And they're as sensitive and reliable as blood tests and neuroimaging, which is why it exists. And it's really helpful in giving us a baseline to track over time.
The book is High Octane Brain, 5 Science-Based Steps to Sharpen Your Memory and Reduce Your Risk of Alzheimer's. Dr. Michelle Braun, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.